Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. Check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. Farmer-owned, Vermont-grown, Sunset Lake CBD. Hey listeners, I want to tell you about Music Masters Collective, a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. These events give you the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like the Fab Four, Steve Earle, Richard Thompson, John Scofield, Nels Klein, the Milk Carton Kids, and many more. This June, join the Wait Band, featuring members of the band and the Levon Helm Band with special guests, including Jimmy Vivino, Bob Margolin, Lost Leaders, Chris O'Leary, Cindy Cashdollar, Stony Creek Band, Rob Fraboni, Larry Packer, and so many more at Camp Cripple Creek. This all-inclusive music vacation in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York promises to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience featuring performances, workshops, jams, comfortable lodging, and superb dining. Visit campcripplecreek.com/undermine to register today. That's campcripplecreek.com/undermine.
Osiris.
You should hear what happens before the mic's turned on. Before it would be crazy. It'd be crazy if this stuff got out. Hello, this is Undermine Season 4, and welcome to Episode 42. I'm Tom Marshall, and I'm the person who says things to you about this tour. Fall 97, the tour that changed everything, according to everyone. We are diving into each show from that tour on the actual 25th anniversary of when it was played. Today, we're in Dayton, Ohio, 12/7/97. Joining me today is longtime Dayton 97 truther, twice impeached Pennsylvania state senator and exiled dictator of Trinidad, RJB. Hey, RJ.
Hey, Tom. The time has come for me to listen to Dayton 97 again. This is it. This is one of the most important, possibly the most important shows of my fish-going career to date. And we have a guest today who, without his service to the community, I might not even have made it to this show. So that it's going to be a lot.
It's but Trey. Before, Trey again?
I don't know. You don't want people. No, everyone don't tune out, but it's not Trey. Before we find out who changed the trajectory of my first fish journey, in addition to Trey, I have to ask you all to please consider subscribing to Osiris Premium. You can support our small business, get a bunch of ad-free and bonus content. Go to osirispod.com/premium or click on the link in the show notes. Okay, Tom, who do we have?
We have a wonderful guest today. It's Andy Gadiel. Andy, of course, is a huge friend of Osiris, having been on the original Under the Scales and then in every fish podcast we've done, including, I think, every season of Undermine. So we're honored to have him back. And the reason we keep bringing him back is not only because he's a fount of fish knowledge, but he's also a very nice person who helped found Jambase and jambands.com and had the original fish page on the web called gadiel.com. And that might be a great place to get caught up with him. There he is. Hey, Andy, how are you?
That's good. How are you?
We are doing phenomenally. And Andy, we're just going to dive right in here. For those who have never logged into the internet, can you tell the audience briefly about the resource you created for the fish community and how that came about?
Well, first off, it's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me on the show. Created a fan site. So for those who have just recently got on the internet, a web fan site was back before the bands were getting on the web. The fans had to figure it out themselves. And so I created a website, and for lack of a better name, I called it Andy Gadiel's Fish Page. And it was really a college project because they give you unlimited access to the computer lab. And I went online and was talking to all of you who are listening today and sharing information and publishing it. And it caught on and people kept contributing and it kind of grew and grew and grew. So
Awesome. That's awesome. Before websites, fans had to figure it out themselves, he said. But before bands, fans had it really tough. But so we're not going to go back that far.
We figured it out.
I have to say, Andy, so I've told you this before, and maybe even we've talked about it on a podcast, but I lived in Ohio, and we had dial up, and I was in high school. I think 95 was the first time that I really like went through the AOL, inserted the AOL CD and tried to get on the internet. And any time the fish was on tour between 95 and 2000, I guess, the first thing I did, I would try to get on the internet, and it would take a while. And then I would go to your page, and then I would try to find out what they played, and I would get news about what's happening next. And so thank you for allowing me to learn about fish and to maybe even like have made it to as many shows as I did, because you were essential in that journey. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for contributing as well. I look back and you did submit some information.
I think it's a testament to
us all kind of seeking connection craving information and wanting to go someplace to see others who were into what we were into. And Rec Music Fish and the Fishnet were certainly instrumental. I was an extension of that in giving people a place to go that they knew they could go back to get to where they wanted to go. So I tried to link off to as many places as possible and give people a resource that they felt like you did that they could go back to and connect. So thank you. It was fun.
That's awesome.
It still is.
RJ, that means that your media career began in 1997, actually.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair. I probably did in some way. I definitely was like, I connected with tape traders, and then I would get the tapes through the tape trees, and then I would make copies for like 10 of my friends, and I would give them bags of tapes like at Christmas time, like 10 of my friends. I would just give them paper bags filled with new fish tapes, which I think was like, that was my service to the community. All right, Andy. So this date 97, this was a Sunday show. We'll never know, but maybe this was the show that made people say don't miss a Sunday show, but there's no way to tell that. But how did you make it to Dayton on that Sunday, December 7th, 1997?
I drove from Detroit. I went to the show the night before, and I was living in Chicago at the time. So I drove out to Michigan and Ohio to meet up with some friends, and we went to the Palace and then went down to Dayton. And I remember the weather was an issue. I think there was a looming snowstorm, or they had already started snowing. Yes, it was a Sunday show, and I knew I had to get back home, I believe, to work on Monday. So I kept the drive ahead after the show in my mind, and just went into the show knowing that I would have some time afterwards.
And how many shows had you seen before this? I mean, like fish and on this tour?
Oh, on this tour, I had only seen one in Champaign, and I had seen a bunch of shows in 96 and a bunch of shows in 95, but I'm a relative newbie, so I didn't start seeing fish until the mid 90s. But I was at the Great Went, and that was instrumental and profoundly impactful. And so, fall 97, though, I experienced mostly from people calling me with the set lists and reporting on it every single show and keeping up with what was happening and very much a part of the conversation. And I tell you, it was having not get to hear the shows until way later, once I got your bag of tapes during the holidays, it felt very special, this tour, just in terms of the bust outs and the four song sets and all these, you know, what we were hearing and what we were learning about the new funk jams that were evolving, definitely gave us something to pay attention to when the shows came, and they didn't disappoint, as this podcast is evidence of.
25 years later, we're sort of, we're trying to relive this as in every way we can. However, the weather's not super cooperative. We don't have incredible snowstorms. RJ, did you also have issues getting to and from this show?
Yeah. So I went, like Andy, I went to the Detroit show the night before and stayed at my parents' house from Toledo, right over the border from Michigan. And the next morning I went down there and had a friend who went to the University of Dayton. But the following day, Monday, December 8th, was my first ever college exam. So I was a freshman and I was planning on like spending the night and maybe trying to figure out how to postpone it or something. But, you know, like your first semester in college, I didn't know anything about anything, like how to do anything, or like, I was like, I don't know, maybe I'll figure it out. But after the show, I decided to drive back to Columbus. So I remember getting to my dorm room at like, you know, 3 a.m. and I got up at like 8:30 and went and took my first college exam at 9, and I got an A. So that's why I continued to see fish, because it seems like it all worked great, except I was really tired. But that was like, it's like your first time when you're able to be free and not listen to what anyone tells you to do. And I don't know, it all worked out, but it was what a show. Andy, the first set, I mean, a lot of these shows in Fall 97, the first sets are as good or better than the second set. But this first set has like some legendary moments, you know, like let's just dive in. I don't think I had ever heard the song Psycho Killer before this. And, you know, like an AC/DC bag opener was not surprising, but you know, 3 minutes in or something, it felt to me like a totally different kind of show from any fish show I'd seen before that.
I agree. You can hear. And this show, of course, was widely circulated at the time and then later released in Soundboard Glory and is out in all the live fish and streaming services. So you can timestamp it pretty clearly that, like, right as it's getting going, the AC/DC band, you can tell it's off to the chase and is definitely going somewhere very quickly and segues into Psycho Killer for the first time since 93. And one wonders if, you know, reminiscing on your interview with Trey from earlier this tour, if they were listening to it on the bus and it was just an extension of what was happening on the bus. One might never know. But it definitely felt like intentional and exciting. They showed up to play that first segue right into Psycho Killer. We knew we were in for a special night.
Just, it's just amazing. And it, again, for many people, probably it's like, this is, the show is just, you know, every moment is kind of like ingrained in my brain. Like every time I go back to listen to it, it's just, it's so fun. Into the Jesus Just Left Chicago, which again, really nice, like really cool blues jam there. Where were you on the, at the venue, and at what point did you know that this was going to be a legendary show? Was it during the, during that, those first few songs?
I definitely felt, so I was up halfway up the audience on Paige's side, and could, and I, if memory serves, I think it was right in the middle of that AC/DC Beck Psycho Killer, where I was like, all right, they came to play tonight. And those first three songs, didn't let up. I mean, even Jesus Left Chicago, which is sometimes a slower number, it felt like they were approaching it with vigor and intentionality, to the point where it was just like out of the gates, something else was happening on this Sunday. Then, you know, I had heard, My Mind's Got a Mind of Its Own earlier in the year, over the summer at the Gorge, but even that was a nice break for a moment, just to have a nice, enjoyable. I always like hearing that one.
If you added up, RJ, you probably know these kind of stats, but like Psycho Killer is rare, and especially these days, but Cities is not. And in a way, they're kind of similar to me, but I almost would have wished that Psycho Killer had won out over Cities. Do you prefer one or another? And is it true Psycho Killer was not played that much after that?
Only four times.
That's really interesting. If you had to choose between the two.
Yeah.
I mean, Cities has just led to so many huge jams.
I know.
But as a song, it's like a way cooler, more unique song. I don't know. What do you think, Andy?
I wouldn't trade the Deer Creek 97 Cities for anything. But we're not talking about summer 97.
Yeah.
I think the influence, the Talking Heads influence is certainly profound, and
totally.
It's cool to see them give nods to their musical influences in different ways.
Love it.
Yep. I happened to see I'm in the 50% club for this song. So I happened to see the one after this that they played, which was August 14th, 2009 in Hartford. So I saw the two middle versions of the four, which is kind of a pretty random coincidence. Unless they were playing it for me, which is definitely, you know, definitely possible. Don't you think, Tom? Given my love of Dayton 97, I think it's definitely possible.
I'd say for sure. Yep.
It's definitely possible. But Andy, what else? Like, I mean, the whole thing is basically one big jam chart, this first set. I think the It's Ice with the Swept Away Steep back into It's Ice is also, you know, super fun. Like, it doesn't let up at all, but obviously the theme and the tube and the jam and the slave, I mean,
well, yeah, that's
like its own thing.
The It's Ice, I thought, was beautiful. And the segue into Swept Away, I love to see it. I'm a really big fan of those two songs. And especially my least favorite part of Steep is when they scream excessively in the live versions. They've done it on the album version, but this version they did not. And I was pleased to see that. And they just hit the chord to It's Ice to go back into the end of It's Ice. I love that sandwich. And so that felt special in and of itself. It was just it felt like a really well-constructed first set up to this point. And the playing, the tightness, there was certainly a lot of active listening happening. I mean, at this point in Fall 97, they are dialed in, you know, to everything that came before that we've of course heard about, on this podcast. And so at this point in the show, and also this venue, I think we'd have to go back and look. It may have been the smallest venue that they played the whole tour. And in terms of their 10,000, I think is the size of the concert here. And it felt like a small half arena as opposed to the bigger Hamptons and the Centrums. But so yeah, halfway through the first set at this point, I think it was on. And then the theme from the bottom, 10 minutes strong, Fall 97 themes, excellent. And this one, no exception. And I'm biased around theme from the bottom. It was the first song I ever heard Phish play live. Deer Creek 95 is one of my favorite songs. Beautiful lyrics. It's an incredible anthem and just feels like one of the most mature songs of theirs at the time, kind of as a complete piece. And so I definitely felt like I was dialed in at this point.
There's a top. I was going to say there has to be a top theme from the bottom from Fall 97, like the best ever played. Would you agree?
Yes, certainly. It's just, they were playing with such authority and ownership of the moment. And you could hear it in the confidence. And it was patience, everyone could go back and listen to it and form their own. But at the time, being there, it felt timeless.
Yeah. I mean, man, first of all, Andy, I've never thought about the size of the arena as it relates to the kind of like special nature of the show, but definitely like going from the Palace the night before and even some of the other venues on that tour, it was much smaller. And I don't think I had a camera because like I didn't carry cameras, but there's a picture that's basically like in my mind, burned into my mind from that show. And I remember, I think I was probably like further back from you, but Page side, like sort of in the middle. And they were like giant, like that, all over that tour. And I mean, in 1.0 generally, they're like giant balloons. There were like several of them that kept like bouncing around on the floor. And I just remember it being like, the whole thing just felt like so, like we were in a special moment in time, which was just so cool to reflect on.
Turned out to be true.
And what happened next was as special as it gets.
Yeah. Tell us about it.
Tube. First time jammed out.
Yeah.
And this is totally dialed in. And you could hear, I somehow put in my set list notes that the Tube jam was similar to the post Isabella jam from the night before, which many have thought, and I would back this up, that if you took the second set from the Palace the night before and the first set from this show and put them together, it's like one big show, and you know, Saturday, Sunday night. And you could tell that it was a continuum that was going on. And the Tube jam got so good and funky, and then they ended Tube, and bless the soundboards, you could hear Trey and Fishman and Paige talking, and Trey's like, let's just start that jam back up again. let's just go from there. Let's play the jam. And they just started the jam back up again because they were having so much fun with it. And so that was pretty amazing, pretty awesome.
The just Tube jam. Magical. And like you said, the soundboard, before the soundboard, you really just like, you heard them just start it again. And it was so fun to go back and listen to, even on the tapes, just because it felt like one of those like really just organic moments, you know, where it was just like, we're into this thing. And then they kind of repeated that in the Island tour and, you know, like sort of just like, let's keep doing that thing. But this, the jam part that goes into Slave becomes so patient and beautiful. It's not like it just, I don't know how they do it, but they very, very slowly kind of make their way to Slave.
Yeah, highly recommended. If anyone hasn't heard it, must listen. The jam into Slave, probably one of the best sequences of Phish music I've ever heard. And the Slave, multiple peaks and just relentless and keeps going. Just exclamation point ending to the set. It is a beautiful, raging, reigning bliss Slave.
Is definitely one of the best Slaves that I've heard in this all these re-listens that I've been engaging in. I can see you guys are saying about this show for sure. In terms of the first set, this is a crushing first set, an incredible first set. What's the length? Was it longer? Were you thinking it was setting up for a four song second set?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it definitely was an hour. I don't know. We'd have to go look.
Yeah, it was pretty standard length. It just was so packed with just amazing. I mean, in contrast to a lot of the other shows of this tour, there weren't a lot of long jams. Like the Tube was probably 12 minutes. The Slave was 12 minutes. And everything else was, you know, like the AC/DC bag Psycho Killer thing was like, you know, 5 minutes of each song. But it was so perfect. But nice. You do get a lot of songs here, you know, in comparison to some of the other shows, like the Hampton shows and the others that we've talked about that were like really like just pushing a couple long jams together.
And so this is totally jam-packed with concise jams. And before we start that jam again, let's take a quick break.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than a million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com, that's distrokid with a capital K, .com/VIP/undermine for a special offer only for our listeners. That's distrokid, capital K, .com/VIP/undermine. Thanks, DistroKid.
Hey, everyone. It's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast. And we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
And we are back with our guest, Andy Gadiel, and we're talking about December 7th, 1997, a day that will forever live in infamy. Andy, for some, this second set is overlooked because of everything we were just talking about before the break about the legendary first set. Is that appropriate?
No, don't sleep on the second set. I mean, the first set was tremendous. However, the second set is no slouch and has some of the most remarkable playing, which we will now remark about.
Let's remark.
So they love to open the second set with Timberhoe. Going back and looking, it seems like this one got a lot of second set opener treatment. And this one definitely gets out there, and you could tell that they are listening to each other. That is a theme of this tour that Trey underscored as well in your interview with him, that there's definitely the improv is fueled by their attention to what the others are playing. And this Timber is no exception to that.
I think it's interesting that this set, again, like kind of what we were talking about with set one, they're not super long, like, you know, less than 10 minutes, but it doesn't really factor in for this show. Like, you wouldn't really know unless you looked at the time, how, how long it was. Like in the Wolfman's also, you know, like 7 minutes. It's they're not spending a lot of time in these jams, but they're getting going so fast.
And the funk theme continues throughout. I mean, it's just, it's ever present, cannot be understated that they were in a zone and wanted to stay in that zone. And we were happy to be in that zone with them. And then the Wolfman's segueing into the first Boogie on Reggae Woman since 88, making it now the biggest bust out of the tour. But the, you know, it became a huge, you know, nobody had any idea where this came from.
What was the bust out prior? The biggest bust out?
Well, the Psycho Killer was from 93.
Oh, gotcha.
But earlier in the show, but then also I'm sure if we go back and look at the, put me on the spot, what were the bust outs of this tour? I mean, this was a tour of Dogface Boy was the first time since 96, Sanity from 96. There was definitely every show had some double digit show bust out. Low Rider from Winston-Salem was 826 shows ago. So this might have been actually not the biggest bust out of the tour. I correct myself. I sit corrected. So, but it's up there. And it was definitely a super awesome funky groove. I had last heard it at my brother's wedding when the wedding band The Manatees had played it. I for a second thought it was their cover, but then I corrected myself again. And all good. And it just felt like they were having fun, and they were everyone was in a great mood, and they were keeping the vibe going, and we were all stoked to be there on a Sunday night.
And then the fish favorite Reba is, I think Trey must love playing and singing Reba and the whole thing. It's a great version.
And this one was particularly special for me. I had begun to notice Reba kind of waning from rotation a little bit. You know, usually they played it every few shows and it hadn't gotten more than a handful of show gap. But then starting around 97, it was like 10 shows, 20 shows. Like this was the second Reba of the tour last since 11-17. And I was kind of chasing it, wanting to hear Reba. Is one of my favorite songs. And I somehow the night before found myself leaving the palace and walking to my car along the side of the arena where the buses were. And I saw Fishman walking into the bus, and I just did what any self-respecting Fish fan would do at that moment. And I yelled Reba as loud as I could. And he turned and looked and walked into the bus. So I feel partially responsible for them playing Reba this night. And what a Reba it was. Glorious.
Thank you for delivering us a good one.
Yeah, thank you for doing that.
If it wasn't me, it would have been you, RJ. So I'm glad because Tom's not responsible for any songs being played. You're not allowed to take credit. No. You only write them.
And I would have made a mistake and yelled Esther at Fish, and then we would have had an Esther. It might have been a great one, but it wouldn't have been this Reba.
You know what's an obscure reference is that Boogie on Reggae Woman was last played in 88 at Sam's Tavern in Burlington, Vermont, a place that Fish played a few times. I don't know if you've ever been to Sam's Tavern.
I have not.
Or if it had anything to do with the show Cheers. But Cliff Clavin's mom was named Esther in the show. And the song Esther was debuted at Sam's Tavern on a different day. Totally apropos to nothing. But
it's not reaching far at all.
That was type three. So let's go move on.
I mean, sounds exactly right.
Yeah. So Reba, the jam in this Reba is so beautiful and patient. Again, soaring. I was feeling so validated in my hobby at this point and felt like I made the right decision to go to Dayton on a Sunday night in a snowstorm. And it's incredible how music can do that to you in this moment with all these people, with my friends. I mean, it was an amazing moment. Anyone who was there, yes, we may have attendance bias, and those who were not there that listened to the show don't think of it as that incredible. But for those that went, it was a very, very special night.
Was your hobby fish or was your hobby music, going to see live music?
Oh, fish. Going to see live fish.
Okay.
I didn't turn pro until the next year.
Gotcha.
And also with the Reba, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, I want you to finish talking about the Reba.
I was done talking about the Reba.
Okay. The Reba is fucking awesome. That's what I wanted to say. No whistling. And then you can hear on the soundboard again that Trey is just like yelling, Gaiuti.
Gaiuti.
You know, they're ready. Man, it didn't slow up the entire show.
And the possum is no token closer. I mean, that was, they were raging the possum to close it. So yeah, the whole second set just continued. There was no let up.
Yeah, this, I mean, I do think that part of the reason that this show has such a great reputation, and Andy, you and I are both from the Midwest and we both love this show, so we're not biased at all, but I do think that this,
and we were there.
But do you think that this could be, can you say that this is the best show of Fall 97? Would people look at you strangely if you said that?
I don't think you can say any show is the best. Fall 97 in and of itself is kind of its own category. And so if I had gone to more shows, if I'd gone to every show, maybe I could have made a judgment, but it's all subjective. I think there are certainly shows that have a different level of exploration and playing. For me, start to finish, this was the most fun show I had seen that tour. I wouldn't make claims of its ranking amongst a tour where everything was A plus. And so I think,
yeah, that's totally fair,
which is why you're doing what you're doing and going through each show, and each show has something super special to offer. I do think that, yeah, I mean, there's ebbs and flows, and maybe some of the bias of this show was the high quality recordings came out very soon after. I was actually going through Rec Music Fish, and there were people clamoring for the tapes of the show the day after. Like, I know it's early, but can I get a tape of this one? Like, the tapers hadn't even gotten home. and so overall, start to finish, it was phenomenal. And even the Day in the Life encore was beautiful and a tribute to John Lennon's birthday, which was the next day, where they didn't have a show, or we made that up, that it was a tribute to John Lennon. But
yeah, the day he died, right? The 8th.
The day he did, the next.
Yeah, I mean, it was. Everyone knew. Everyone who was there knew, anyway. I think, like, this show combined with The Night Before is just such an incredible one to, like, they're so different, but they're both just, like, so perfect. These are two really kind of perfect shows in a row. And I think that, to me, that's one thing that, like, if Sunday was great and Saturday was just okay, it probably would affect my opinion of this Dayton show. But it's just like, I went to Friday also in Cleveland. So it's sort of like the whole weekend just built, you know, and it was just like three awesome nights in a row. So I feel like that's part of it. They kind of have to be considered together, because all of us who were there, like, most people went to The Night Before, and same thing with the Hampton shows, right? Like, most people went to both of them. So they're like, they're kind of together, and that raises the profile of both of them. At least that's my theory.
Good theory.
I think you guys are attendance biasing me a little bit, like shoving me into the corner with your bias. Well, no, I actually don't have, I mean, Hampton so far, I guess, might be just the whole Hampton run might be my favorite, but I'm going to, you know, re-listening to this just today was an absolute delight. So I guess I now have to weigh them a little bit more carefully since that question has been posed. But we know you're a truther, RJ, a Dayton truther.
Did you yeah. head back to, did you go to the next show as well?
Yeah.
After your test?
Yeah, we drove through a snowstorm to get to State College 2 days later.
Which we'll hear about in the next episode.
We will, because that was actually a legit, like, driving through. Oh man, I'll tell the story, because we're gonna get to talk about it in just 2 days. But yeah, did you see others after this, Andy?
I ended up going only to the tour closer and driving all night the 12th to get there in time for the tour ending. They never brought out the dude, but I was there. We'll hear about that to end this.
Yeah, we will.
No reason to listen now that you gave it away.
I know, oh, I know.
Spoiler alert.
People were waiting to see if they did bring out the dude.
I'm still waiting.
Tom referred to me as a Day 97 truther, and that's because I don't believe that this was performed by humans on Earth. I think we were transported to some other dimension because it was just too, it was just too good to have been, to have been worldly.
Sci-fi soldier.
For fish fans that were paying attention at the time, this show just felt special for where it sat in the tour and knowing what was happening, and that this was our favorite thing to do. And you know, everything about it just had asterisks and exclamation points, you know, a lot of arrows between songs, not a lot of commas. You know, that's the sign of a good show.
That means it's a good flow. Show. Yep. Everything's a segue. And when this episode, when our podcast works perfectly, we segue in and out of each other's conversations effortlessly and very fluidly. And watch this. Andy, we've been throwing our guests, especially the ones who make their living in music media, a curveball pitch right at the end of our episodes. And that is, we surprise them with questions about current music. And I'm wondering, what was the most recent concert you saw and who do you most want to go see?
The most recent concert I saw was Tea Leaf Green and Green Sky Bluegrass at the Warfield.
Oh, wow.
In San Francisco. Which was pretty special. Tea Leaf had never played at the Warfield, and Green Sky was wonderful. It was a great night of music.
I think we opened Amphibian, my band, opened for Tea Leaf a long time ago. I'm glad they're still
getting butt. They are out and about when they can.
Good to hear. And who do you most want to go see?
Amphibian. Elevate Me Later. Great cover, you guys do.
Perfect.
I admit I have not seen King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, which everyone keeps raving about. So I still have to. I'm holding out as long as I can, but they're gonna find me one of these days.
Well, that's gonna do it for us today. Thank you, Andy Gadiel, for joining us, and thanks to my co-host, the mayor of Dayton, Ohio, R. Jason B. And thanks to all of you listening and to the Osiris team. And thanks to Cash or Trade, the world's only social network where fans buy, sell, and trade tickets at face value. Check out all the tickets at cashortrade.org. And if you're keeping up at home, the next show is 12/9/97 in State College, Pennsylvania. Benji and RJ will have to drive through a snowstorm to get there, but it'll be worth it. We'll find out. Thank you, Andy, and thank you, RJ.
Thank you.
Osiris.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like The Lumineers, Ani DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Mo, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the corner of Gray Street.